It last week, right before somebody rang this annoying bell on me and made me stop, as I don't know who that person is. And so the issue, of course, was that we have the four major kings in this area that are running things, and they're putting a tariff, not to use that term unjustly, they're putting a tribute on minor kings and have been doing so for years. And this was commonplace during this time. And so the minor kings had kind of five minor kings. This has been going on for 12 years. And the five minor kings decided they kind of had enough of this. And they wanted to rebel. And so they did. On the 13th year, they rebelled. And the 14th year, the four major kings had gotten together and decided to attack them to recover their lost tribute and to make sure they understand who's in charge. And so they do so. And so the four minor kings have been paying this tribute for 12 years. That had a beginning, I mean, tiresome. But it's not the first time it's happened in the Bible, of course. There's many examples in the Bible of kings paying tribute or people paying tribute to other kings. King Hezekiah in 2 Kings 18. Threatened by invasion, Hezekiah admitted to wrongdoing against the Assyrian king and by breaking a previous vassal treaty they had made and refusing to pay the required tribute. And as a result, he paid 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. He had to strip the temple to get the required gold to pay that tribute. And so that has happened before in the Bible. Not unusual that time at all. And so the five minor kings have grown tired of the financial drain of these tributes. And I'm not going to make any tax jokes. I'm not going to make any tax jokes. This is biblical times. But don't get me started. But the financial drain of paying these tribute after 12 years, so they decided to rebel in the 13th year, and they did. Now, this included the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, which, as you know, is going to be an important piece coming up. Now, Genesis 14:4 says, 12 years they served Kedorlaomer, and the 13th year they rebelled. And so they got together, formed an army, and decided to rebel against these kings. Verses 5 through 10 describes the war with the major kings defeating the minor kings, not unexpectedly. Now, the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah were both killed in this action. In verse 10 of chapter 14, and the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and there that remained fled the mountain. So the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah have both been killed in this action and have been left there. The victorious kings took their spoils. They took everything they could get from all the cities, from the kings they captured, including one of the occupants of the city of Sodom, a man named Lot. And that's what's important about the story. They took Lot. Now, Lot was living in the city of Sodom at this point. Remember when the herds of Abram and Lot, the herdsmen were arguing because there wasn't enough space for the herds. They were fighting over the grazing land. And Abram went to Lot and said, listen, there's too many flocks. You pick where you want to go. I'll give you first choice. Although Abram was the senior, he could have chosen first. He gave, in order to compromise, he told Lot, you pick where you want to go. And wherever you go, I'll go the other way. And Lot looked up and saw these wonderful lands, but it was in Sodom and Gomorrah's area. But he picked that. He didn't ask God's permission or direction. He just picked what he thought was the better grazing land. And that's where he went. Now, grazing land in that area wasn't bad enough. He eventually moved into the city of Sodom. And there was no indication in the Bible that he knew about the wickedness of Sodom when he chose those grazing lands. But clearly he heard about it once he occupied those grazing lands. Couldn't have been a secret. And yet he still chose with his family to move into the city, which is a major failure in his part. He should have stayed clear of that. And there's a lesson for us to steer clear of wickedness, because there's wickedness abounds in this earth. And we need to find ways of steering clear of that wherever possible. Even at work, sometimes I don't know how many times at work, both active duty and contractors, I got invited to events at bars where there's lots of drinking. And you kind of go, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm not going to go there and do that. Because they take pictures and they post them everywhere. Everybody drinking, you're sitting there, you don't want to be associated with that. That's the Sodom of that time. You don't want to be associated with it. So just be very careful where you're going and where you're being seen, because that refers back to your testimony. But Lot didn't care, apparently, so he and his family moved into the city. So when it was captured, he was captured with them and taken away. And this is where Abram gets involved. Now, in verse 11 of chapter 14, and they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all the victuals and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, it was his nephew, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Although Lot was Abram's nephew, he treated him like a son. He treated him like almost like an heir. I mean, their relationship was that close. So it wasn't just some nephew. It was a very close family relationship he had with Lot. Again, Lot's bad decision to select this land is now coming back to haunt him. And so we see in verses 13 of chapter 13, and the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. So Lot certainly had to know that before he moved into the city. Bad decisions can lead to bad consequences. I remember one guy I saw that was in self-defense class, when I took a self-defense class years ago. He said, don't go to stupid places at stupid times and do stupid things, because it gets you into trouble. If you go to 7-Eleven at 2 o'clock in the morning in a bad neighborhood, you have to stand a good chance of having something bad happen to you. Now, if you're working, you don't have a choice, that's different. But choosing to do those things can lead to very bad circumstances. Now you say, but I'm free, I can do whatever I want. Yes, you can, as was Lot. And he chose what he wanted to do, and he had to pay a decision for it. So we, and I'm counting myself as an adult here, I'm old enough and acting maybe, but we as adults should try to influence our children, our grandchildren. Please make good decisions about where you're going, who you're being seen with, what are you doing, what time are you doing it, to protect yourself. Not only your testimony, protect yourself physically from what may happen to you. And so we have to be careful to make sure we give the most good advice. So Abram would now hear about Lot's capture from one who had escaped from after the battle had taken place. And although Abraham cared little about the reason for the war or the results of the war, he wanted to rescue his brother's son. So Genesis 14:13 says, and there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre and the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, the brother of Anar, and these were confederate with Abram. Now, this, you see, told Abram the Hebrew. This is the first time in the Bible that anyone, including Abram, has been referred to as a Hebrew. And of course, you see, it goes forward from here. But it's indicating his status as this person who was with Lot had escaped. He addresses Abram as a Hebrew, as the Hebrew. And it means someone who's beyond the Euphrates, a stranger in the land that they were in. That's what it refers to. And that's the first time it's been used. And so Abram gathers together a force to go rescue his nephew, verse 14. And when Abram heard that his brother, his nephew, but he treated him as a brother, had taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. As we talked about last week, he had trained his servants in, at least in the art of defensive warfare, if not offensive warfare. He had trained them up. Here's a person who's looking forward. He's taking care of business. He's making sure they're ready for whatever comes his way. So these aren't 318 people who only use the hoe. These are 318 servants who have been trained as not only servants, but as warriors. And so they were ready to go. They also had three allies who joined with him, Anar, Eshcol, and Mamre. And they brought their people with them. These were three Amorite brothers and local chieftains. So they all went out to battle, and they win the battle. And they get Lot back, verses 15, chapter 14, verse 15. And Abraham wins the battle. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them into Hobah, which is on the left side of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the woman also, and the people. So he recovered Lot, and he recovered the family, and he recovered all the goods that had been taken. Now after the victory, the new king of Sodom, remember the king of Sodom had been killed, but there was a secession. The new king of Sodom is offering Abraham rewards for the victory. Now again, Sodom is what? A wicked city. Do you want to be associated with a wicked place, a wicked city? Even if they're offering you free things, the wicked city still, that title is still there. There's still a wicked city. And so verse 17 says, and the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter at Chedorlaomer, and of the kings that were with him in the valley of Sheba, which is the king's dale. Dale means valley. And so he is going to offer him a reward for getting his goods back. Before that happens, there's an interlude here. And Melchizedek, who is the king of Salem, shows up. He's not close enough to being involved in the battle. He was probably close enough to hear about it. It's about 80 miles from Sodom to where he was in Salem. But he is so impressed and blessed by what Abram has done, he shows up to bless Abram. In verse 18, it says, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem," which is basically Jerusalem, "king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, 'Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand.' And he gave him tithes of all." Abram gave tithes to Melchizedek, the high priest, for his blessings. You see, the stage already been set for tithing, isn't it? So we don't have an excuse. Even back in Genesis, they were tithing. And so he gave Melchizedek a tithe of everything he had taken in the victory of the battle. Now, again, Salem's close enough to have heard about the battle, but not close enough to have been involved in it. About 80 miles, with some scholars say. Now, this interlude reflects God's blessings on Abram for his faithfulness in protecting Lot and his family, which had been blessed by God. And so Melchizedek acknowledges that the God Most High had delivered Abram's enemies to him in this battle. Now, this interlude is over. The blessing is taking place. Now that we go back to the king of Sodom, who says again he wants to reward Abram for saving his kingdom, except Abram wasn't having it. He wasn't going to accept a reward from such a wicked place as Sodom. Verse 21, "And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, 'Give me the persons and take the goods to thyself.'" Now, they had captured a lot of goods. I mean, there was a lot there. It was, I don't want to say it was tempting, but it certainly was a lot of goods. Someone walks up to you and says, "You know what? I'll give you the manager of Walmart. You keep all the goods in the Walmart." Well, that's a lot of stuff. I just use Walmart as an example. If it was Best Buy, I would be really tempted. I mean, seriously tempted. Especially if there were pens in there. You know how much I love writing pens. So at a pen store, I would be really tempted. But he's offering Abram all the possessions if you just give back the people to him in his kingdom. Verse 22, "And Abram said to the king of Sodom, 'I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, than that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich.'" He didn't want it to get out in the newspaper the next day that the king of Sodom had given him something. Because what would that have done to his reputation, to his testimony? The king of Sodom, he's given, "Oh, I thought you were Abram. Why are you taking anything from the king of Sodom?" Again, be careful of that relationship with bad things, because they're going to affect your testimony, be it places you go or even things you're associated with. Abram knew that. He says, "I want no associations with Sodom of any kind whatsoever. You keep your goods, you keep your people, I don't want anything." He makes one exception, though. He says, "Except for food for his soldiers." Verse 24, "Save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, and our Eshcol and Merami, let them take their portion." So he said, give them their whatever you want to give them. Make sure they get food to eat. But I don't want anything from you. I'm not going to take it. And so just be careful of unholy associations with people. I know as a Govy guy, be it active duty or government service, you have to be very careful about those kind of things, because you don't want to be associated with those kind of, even though it's a government-sponsored meeting or event, whatever, you go, everybody's drinking. And it doesn't look good. And it's not good for you to be associated with it. As a contractor, it's worse, because now you have to worry about what your contractor is saying about your failure to participate. Are you reflecting bad on the contract? And we have to be careful as contractors that we don't do something that reflects badly on our contract. Now, I will say this. If not going to a party where there's alcohol is going to get me in trouble with my contractor, so be it. But that's fine. I'll argue that one all day long. I certainly want to make sure I get to work early and I stay late and I do my time recording correctly, because that reflects on my company and I want to make sure I do. I've always done that anyway. But when it comes to those kinds of wicked events, count me out. We've had 2 Christmas parties since I've been here and other things. I'm just... thank you, but I'm not going, but appreciate the invite, because it's drinking and it's, I just don't want to be involved with it. So that's what we should take from this lesson from this, is be careful of our associations with things that aren't holy or that are potentially wicked. Chapter 15, the covenant with Abram. Now, after his victory against these 5 kings, powerful and mighty kings, you can imagine Abram maybe had some concern about retribution from these kings. They were powerful. And so he has prayed to God and asked for protection. And God promises his protection for his servant Abram. Chapter 15, verse 1. After these things, meaning the battle that had taken place, after these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward." I've been praying, and I wish you would pray for our military right now, because there's a potential conflict in the Middle East that's looming. And so I pray every day that our soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, and space guardians are protected. Because if they're involved in a military action, we should pray for their protection. We also pray for their success, but we should pray for their protection, because the potential there is to lose a lot of people. And they were successful in Honduras. Help me out. It was Say again.
Venezuela.
They were so successful in Venezuela. Thank you. They lost their life. A few injuries. They didn't lose their lives. But that was a harrowing exercise or operation that took place in, with a lot of activity going on, a lot of shooting going on. Thankfully, we didn't lose any soldiers, didn't lose any people in the battle. But a war in the Middle East is another different area higher than that because of the threat. So please pray for our military, that if there's something like that happens, they're protected and they're also successful, because there's a lot of wickedness there that can be overturned, and the people in Iran are trying to do that themselves. But there's a chance we can get involved with it. And so Abram was facing potential retribution for what he had done. And God says, "I got your back. I'm going to be your shield. And I'm going to protect you." Now, so let's reset the focus here. The battle's over. Abram is going back to his regular life. He's 85 years old, between 75 and 85 years old. And Sarai, they still have no children. And God continually promises to make of him a great nation. But they still had no children. And so even though the lifespans are larger than they are now, about 200 years, it is significantly less than what it used to be when it was 900 years, 600 to 900 years. So Abram and Sarai are facing this mounting pressure. God's promising us, but we have no children. And so it must be tremendous pressure on them. Genesis 12:2 says, "And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing." But they have no children yet. And so now God never asks us, promises us anything that we're not able to do. He never asks you to do something we're not able to do. He says, "Dave, I want you to run a 4-minute mile." Not going to happen. I have a hard time driving a 4-minute mile. And not getting in a crash. So God's never going to ask you to do something that you're not capable of doing. But if he asks you to do something, if he leads you into doing something, if he leads you into teaching or preaching or doing special events with home care, he's not going to let you do that unless you're able to do that. He's not going to ask you to do that unless you're able to do that. That's why I don't sing, because I have no talent, and even God's not leading me that way. I prayed hard about this. He said, "Dave, if you sing, the church will leave." So I'm not singing. I told you when I was 6, I had my adenoids, tonsils, and vibrato removed. And so I can't sing. But still, God never asks us to do more than we're capable of doing. And here he's saying the same thing to Abram. But Abram and Sarai, the pressure is exceeding. And so Abram asks God if he can adopt Eleazar, which is a servant of his son, therefore providing a bloodline and an heir. Not uncommon in this area during this time to adopt a offspring of one of your servants to be your heir if you have no children of your own. A fairly common practice. But Abram had been promised something by God. Verse 15, or chapter 15, verse 2. "And Abram said, Lord God, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eleazar of Damascus? And Abram said, Behold, to me there was given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir." So he's saying, there's this young boy, I could take him and use him as my heir. And he's trying to find a human solution to what God has promised him. And God's, again, not having it. Again, customary at the time to do this. He thought it would meet the need. And he's trying to give God a helping hand here. But God affirms his promise. They will have a biological son of his own. Verse 4 of chapter 15. "And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, This shall not be thine heir." Talking about Eleazar. "But he shall come forth out of thine own bowels, shall be thine heir. And he brought him forth abroad and said, Look now toward heaven and tell the stars, if thou be able to number them. And he said unto him, So shall thy seed be. Another affirmation of the promise to Abram that his seed will be countless. And so chapter 6 says, verse 6, and he believed in the Lord and he counted for him for righteousness. So God promised Abram a child of his own, not an heir, not one he could pick from some other family, but a child of his own. Now, again, Abram is getting old. He's asking God here, how will I know that I will inherit the land? Verse 7. And he said unto him, I am the Lord, and brought thee out of Ur of the Chaldees, to give thee this land to inherit it. And Abram says, and he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? Abram is asking the question of God, how am I going to know this? Is this a lack of faith? Understand the pressure he's under. He's getting older. His wife's getting older. They have no child. He's been promised all this. He's wondering, am I failing it somehow? You ever have something happen? You wonder, am I failing somehow? I've been praying for this. This isn't happening. Is this my fault? And it could be pressure on us as people praying for a good thing. You go, am I the reason this isn't happening? Am I doing something wrong? Abram is questioning, am I doing something wrong, Lord? Can we use this person? Nope, it's going to be from you. And so Abram's doing a lot of soul searching here. And so he's just, the pressure is, he's asking God for a tangible sign of confirmation. Not out of doubt, but to solidify his faith. God, give me a sign. Now, there's been chance other stories in the Bible about the same thing happening. Gideon, to confirm God's promise of deliverance, asked for a sign of putting fleece of wool on the floor, asking for it to be wet with dew when the ground was dry, and then the reverse, to prove it, and God did it. Moses, of course, who was questioned if the people would believe him, God gave him signs, including a staff which turned to a serpent, his hand becoming leprous, to confirm his mission. And Hezekiah asked for a sign to know that he would be healed. Hezekiah was old. God had already said to him, you're going to die. And Hezekiah prayed the Lord and thanked him, and the Lord says, look, I've heard you. I'm going to give you 15 more years of life to take care of things. And Hezekiah says, well, give me some confirmation this is going to happen. And he asked for the sundial to go backwards 10 degrees. And he said, well, you want to go forward or backwards? And he said, well, going forward is too easy. I'm not sure how that is. But he said, make it go backwards. And it went backwards 10 degrees to confirm the promise it made to him. So it's not uncommon in the Bible for great men of God to ask for signs. And so Abram had asked for a sign. Now God says he directs a formal, traditional covenant ritual requiring specifically aged animals to confirm the covenant. Chapter 15, verse 9. And he said unto him, Take me an heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Notice the specificity of the command here. It must be 3 years old. And there's a purpose for that. And so, verses 10 and 11, he takes these things, he lays them out, offers them a sacrifice, lays out their carcasses, and according to how the ritual is supposed to take place, he scares away the birds. Get off my ritual. Get off my sacrifice here. He keeps it clean. He keeps it ready. He drives them out. Keeps the ritual clean for God. Now, this direction from God to make a specific sacrifice signified a binding covenant, as if Abram needed yet more confirmation. God's offering it right here. It sealed the promise made to him and reinforces Abram's faith. Abram said, God, give me a sign. Okay, here. Do this, and here's your covenant. And God will sometimes provide a sign to us just when we need it most to bolster our faith. And so look for that. Now, Abram's made this sacrifice, and so God's going to speak to him. He reveals the future Egyptian slavery of Israel, and the land is not theirs, starting in verse 13. Verse 12, a deep sleep falls upon Abram, verse 13. And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve, well, I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with a great substance. Who are we talking about here? Egypt, the Egyptian bondage, 400 years. Now, Abram has been given the affirmation that his covenant is fulfilled, will be fulfilled, but he's being told, but they're going to be subjugated for 400 years. I'm just telling you. But it'll be followed by a great judgment against their oppressor, Egypt, and a precipitous or prosperous exile. They'll leave with lots of goods. And so the people will suffer, but God will rescue them and rescue them from their affliction. But on God's time, not in our time. And so that's what he promises to them. But he also promised him a peaceful death at a good old age. And research that his sentence will endure that 40 years of bondage to a foreign land, Egypt, before returning to Canaan with great substance. Verse 15. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. So he said, in the fourth generation, 40 years, they'll be released from this bondage. Verse 17. And it came to pass, and when the sun went down, it was dark. Behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. So to signify, for God to signify to Abram the covenant, he has all these carcasses laid out by this for this ritual, exactly as God had promised them or told him to do. And so there was a smoking furnace and a burning lamp was going between them, floating between these carcasses to show God's commitment to the covenant. And so this is God formally affirming this covenant to Abram by giving him a specific land and to reward them with getting out after 400 years. And so verse 18. And the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. And it lists all the peoples there that will be taken. So this affirmation, continuing affirmation, Abram's old, his wife is old, they have no children. And he keep asking for affirmation. And God keeps providing him affirmation. This is going to happen. I'm telling you, this is going to happen. Just trust in me. It's going to happen. And he makes a great sacrifice. And God provides this visible signal of his affirmation of this covenant to him. Now, chapter 16. We get into the birth of Ishmael. In Genesis 15, 2 and 3, Abram acknowledges God's promise to make him a great nation. But again, concerned about they don't have any children. Verse chapter 15, 2. And Abram said, Lord God, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eleazar of Damascus? Remember, he tried to use Eleazar as his heir. And God says, no, it'll come from you. But they're still childless, and this pressure is building. Now, we can fault Abram here, but I'm not going to fault him. Because, again, I've never imagined the kind of pressure you'd be under. I mean, think about pastors, the kind of pressure that pastors have to operate under. With people who have 100 different needs and wants and desires. And what did he say yesterday? Somebody who does themselves as a pastor corrector. Remember that story? In a meeting yesterday, he said he went to church one time where this gentleman, every time the pastor preached, he would go up to the pastor afterwards and correct him about something he'd said. And one day he says, God has appointed me as a pastor corrector. And he was serious, apparently. And so the pastors have to, what do you say to somebody like that? There's the door. No, you can't. But you have to try to work with somebody. And you have people with needs and wants and desires. You have wonderful people that do great things. And you have wonderful people who want to do great things. And you have losers that show up and try to do things. And so, but if the pastor, the pressure of pastor is enormous. And again, same thing for their wives. Because they hear about it, try to do their best to help. But that's nothing compared to when God himself has promised you a nation. And here you are, past middle age, and still they have no children. And so they try to do something themselves to try to rectify the situation. And you see that Sarai does this on her own. And so if my thing, well, there it goes. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had an handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said unto Abram, behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. Again, not uncommon to do this for a childless family, for the patriarch of the family, to use a servant to bear children. It was not uncommon in his time to do that. But this is in direct contradiction to God's commandment, to God's order to them. This will come from your bowels. This will come from your children. And Abram says, okay, never argue with your wife. Okay, never argue with your wife. Can I get an amen from that? Never argue with your wife. You're not going to win. Now, should he have said something? Yes, he should have said, wait a minute, we have God's commitment here. But he didn't. He said, okay. So impatience got the better of both of them. And again, Abram is somewhere between, he's getting close to 85 years old. He dies at 175, so he's already kind of past middle age here. And with the reduced lifespans after the flood, they don't know how long they're going to live. And so he was getting on in years. And so she said, here, take her, have a child with Hagar so we at least have, you know, a bloodline. Verse 3. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. 10 years had elapsed since the last confirmation of the covenant, and still no children. And so Sarai, impatient, made a bad decision and said, I'm going to fix this. And so here's my handmaid, and you go ahead and have a child with her. Not uncommon, not necessarily even her fault. She just was concerned that God's promise would be fulfilled. And she figured this would be the best way to do it. Verse 4, and he, meaning Abram, went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress, Sarai, was despised in her eyes. So Hagar's immediate pregnancy. Sarai had been trying to have a child forever. And Hagar gets pregnant like that. And you imagine, there was not a good feelings here between Sarai and her. And she had contempt for her. She was despised in her eyes. It infuriated Sarai that she had gotten pregnant so quickly. So having initiated the plan for Hagar to conceive for her, Sarai feels despised and accuses Abram of failing to protect her dignity, ultimately passing responsibility for the resulting domestic strife on him. Amen, men? But we are guilty. It's always our fault. We always are guilty. I mean, we have to admit to that. Even when we're not, we're still guilty. It's our fault. Verse 5, and Sarai said to Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid unto thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judged between me and thee. She felt that the Hagar was looking at her like, no. And so she felt despised. Now, again, Sarai, you have to have patience and you have to have mercy for this young lady. She's been trying to conceive forever. She's been faithful. She's been doing the right thing. And still no children. And she makes this decision, not the greatest decision in the world, but she makes a decision to try to be helpful. And it immediately happens, and she feels so bad about it because it happened so quickly. So let's give her a break because she's feeling just the pressure is getting to her. And so Abram ceases to console his wife by telling her to do whatever you want to with Hagar. verse 6. But Abram says unto Sarai, behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. So Sarai got all over Hagar and basically just treated her very badly. And Hagar fled. She left the situation. She reduced Hagar's role back to a slave instead of as a concubine, which she should have been. And so even though it was her legal right, it emphasized her displeasure with this whole situation. And so the result of this bad decision led to more bad decisions. And so she just basically banishes Hagar back to the slave house. And Hagar feels like, I've got to leave. And so she flees. Chapter 16, verse 7. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountains in the way of Shur. And he said, "And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou? And whither thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress, Sarai. She felt she had to get out. She felt that was her only escape. And so the Lord finds her by a fountain. Verse 9. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress and submit thyself unto her hands. Go back and take up whatever role Sarai gives you. Take the role and be satisfied with it. So sometimes God makes us go back, even the situation is not an easy one. You ever been in a difficult job situation? You want to leave. The job situation is not good and you want to leave, but sometimes you can't. I did, but that's okay. God bless me anyway. But job situations can be very difficult for you. Family situations can be extremely difficult for you. Always pray and ask for God's guidance before you take any actions, because the actions can be worse than just being faithful and staying true by what God wants you to do. Marital issues, family issues, health issues, these are all struggles we have to put up with. And so we should seek God's guidance in these instead of acting irrationally or acting without thinking things through. And so God makes a promise to Hagar in verse 10. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, and it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, thou art with child, thou shalt bear a son, and thou shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. Now again, Hagar had done nothing wrong. She had done exactly what she was supposed to do. She was a victim of circumstances. But God will reward her for her faithfulness both as a servant and as a mother-to-be for Abram. Now, Ishmael means God hears. So he gives a name. He names the baby God hears to show that he was hearing what Hagar was saying as she fled. Verse 12, and he will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. Now Ishmael is an interesting figure, to put it mildly. All right, he is conceived and born under very challenging circumstances. He has a conflict later with Isaac, resulting in his and his mother being cast out. We'll talk about that. God protects them both in the desert and promised Hagar that he would make of her a great nation and make of her son a great nation. And that he, Ishmael, would be the father of 12 princes. And in fact, he was. And so Ishmael is a very interesting character here. So Hagar praises and thanks God for seeing her affliction in verse 13. And she called the name of the Lord that spaketh unto her, that God seeth me. For she said, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? So Hagar acknowledges that God's eyes were upon her as is upon us at all times, despite her dire situation as a pregnant, outcast slave. Can you imagine that? You're pregnant, you've left your house, you have no means of income, and you're out there by a fountain, and God finds you and restores you. So God cares for us despite all of our circumstances. So we'll finish up at verse 16. And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. He was 86 years old. Again, longer lifespans, but this is still quite old to be having a son. And he finally had a son, but it was not the one that God had promised him. And so despite her wife's intention to try to make something happen, here, Abram, let me adopt my nephew. Let me adopt this person from a family. No, God said, that's not how it's going to happen. Well, look, have one of my maid. And God said, no, that's not going to happen. But he didn't punish the people that had been involved in this because it wasn't their fault. The maid had no choice. The servant had no choice. And so God blesses her and will bless her offspring. So that's where we'll stop for today, because chapter 17 talks about the circumcision of Abram, and I don't want to get into that this morning, this early. But it talks about circumcision of Abram, what that meant, and the fact it resulted in a name change for him and Sarai. And you know, of course, what those name changes are. And so very significant times are coming forth in chapter 17 and onward. So again, be prayerful about what you'd like to see covered. We'll finish with Abraham probably next week or so. I'm not going to get into everything because it gets very, very deep, and I'm just going to do a high overflow of the rest of his life and those of his offspring, and then we'll get into the apostles, hopefully before long, maybe by Easter time, we'll get into the apostles, we'll study them, because I think it's a fascinating study to see them both in the Bible as well as historically who they were, what they did. I mean, Matthew was a tax collector for the Levi, tax collector, hated amongst his own people because he was a tax collector for the wrong side. And yet he wrote, God used him. By the way, when you hear me say that men wrote the Bible, I meant that God used them to write the Bible. They were pens to write the Bible. You know how much I love pens. So they were just simply pens to write what God gave them. And so you get a bold pen, a thin pen, a red pen, a blue pen. They're still pens. They didn't create it. They just wrote what God gave them to write. So every time you hear me say somebody wrote something, it's God used them to write something in the Bible. And so we'll get into that. We'll have some fun with that. All right, let's have a prayer. Father, again, thank you for the chance together.